Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later on in the program, we're going to have Reverend Gail Tapscott talking about Unitarianism and Mary Poppins, believe it or not. Right now, I would like to welcome the folks from the play, which is about to be produced later this week, called Through the Mirror. Winston Morris Green is here with us. He's playwright, producer, director, and actor. Izzy Buckner and Ryan Kochevar, actors, are also here with us. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having us.
So this is a play, I mean, all of you are about the age to be potentially active service in Iraq. You've chosen to write a play about Vietnam.
That's correct.
Why Vietnam?
Well, when I was writing it, I feel that as artists we have a responsibility to say things that are going on in our society right now, and I felt that if I made a story about a draft that was going on in the Iraq War, it would be a little too topical for people to really appreciate the play itself. So I picked the Vietnam War, because it has a lot of similarities to what's going on right now.
What do you see as the similarities?
The deaths and maiming of soldiers that are going over. I mean, I for one know people who have gone over and haven't come back the same, or have come back disfigured, or have not come back at all. You guys have similar experiences, right?
Yeah, I know a couple people.
That's one of them. Another is the fact that this is another war with an amazing amount of people coming back with post-traumatic stress disorder, which I didn't happen as much in Korea and Grenada, I suppose. another similarity is that regardless of your political views right now, I don't think anyone wants to be in this war right now. I mean, no one wants to be in Iraq, regardless of whether you support President Bush or not. And same thing, whether or not you supported Nixon. I don't think there were a lot of people out there who were going, oh yeah, pro-Vietnam War, we love sending people off to die.
to die and kill.
Exactly.
So the three of you, there's more characters than the three of you in this play, but you play a brother, a sister, and the best friend who's dating the sister, as comes out pretty quickly. The brother gets drafted, the best friend enlists. How did you come up with the characters, and how did you develop them, all of you, who've presumably never been in war zones?
Well, development was the cause of very too much coffee. That was just my mistake. No, I guess I just started writing. I mean, the original concept for it was Guy, Adam Stern, who deals with this. How does he come out the other end? That's all the premise was for the show. And as I wrote, I just kind of started coming up with ideas for characters and the interactions they could have with each other. And, well, could this work? Could this work? Could this work? So it just kind of came to me as I was writing.
And so how did you, for example, Jake, you have to get yourself into the mindset of somebody who actually wants to go to war, unlike your best friend?
Winston being our fearless director in this whole thing, I think I'd follow him to war anyway.
I think I just called you Jake, which is your character.
Yeah, he does it all the time. Okay. He refuses to call me Ryan. I think that if any true friend that you've grown up with and been around is going to look after you if something this big happens to you. And also, I go to war partially because I feel guilty about dating his sister, so, yeah.
The psychology of that being a little twisted.
Oh, yes, yeah.
And then you, Izzy, playing the sister, have to deal with the sort of innocence and loss of innocence.
It's really interesting because I actually got my part 2 weeks ago, and so it's been a rocky road trying to find the character and whatnot because it's just not very much time to find someone, if that makes any sense.
So how do you go about it? I mean, what's that? You have to do it quickly, but what's the process?
The first thing is really, memorizing lines is really the first step, and then you just have to get into the mindset of these people. Like, instead of being a 19-year-old in Santa Fe, New Mexico in 2008, I am a 20-something-year-old back in the 60s. And you just have to try and figure out what those people were thinking at that time.
Have you been watching other movies, or all of you reading books from that era?
I think Winston has.
Yeah.
Yeah, Apocalypse Now once too many times.
Really?
Well, I have a photographic memory, so you watch a movie once and I can just replay it in my head, so that's fun. We have been listening to the music and stuff. I thought it would be fun for us to listen to protest songs and such, so we all had to go down to Albuquerque to get fatigues and stuff, and I made us this CD of just, you know, these great, amazing protest songs about these people just telling stories about, you know, how they felt about it going on, and some really obscure ones were snuck in there too, one or two.
Do you use any of that music as a soundtrack in the play?
Absolutely. I think we used almost all of them actually.
Yeah.
As soundtrack.
Yeah.
It's transition musics, if not actually in the show. When it comes to music in the show, I think I cheated once. I always found it really cheesy when you're watching something and music just kind of pops out of nowhere and fits perfectly. So, at least it's experience in my life, if music pops in perfectly and makes me really annoyed because it's there and I feel like I'm in a movie, it usually comes out of my radio. So I wanted to do the same thing. A lot of times if there's music playing, it's because someone turned on a phonograph or they're sitting in a diner and it's playing overhead. I mean, that's where all the music really comes from in the show.
We're talking to Winston Morris Green, Izzy Buckner, and Ryan Kochevar. The play is called Through the Mirror, and it opens this Thursday at Warehouse 21. And this is the new warehouse, the new and improved Warehouse 21. Is it the first play that's going up there?
Yes.
What is that space like? Did all of you work in the previous one as well?
Yeah. I think we all in some capacity or another.
What is the new space like, and how does it accommodate the kind of things that you're doing?
Echoey.
Oh, dear. Let's talk to the acoustic designers and architects.
Yeah.
Bring them on the show.
No,
echoey.
It's great. I mean, they've got an elevator that runs on corn oil, you know, for Pete's sake. I mean, it's a fantastic building. I mean, of course, they're still working out the kinks. Because it's a new building. It's pretty interesting. We started out on the second story in the place that's reserved for theater shows and stuff like that. But due to some technical errors, which we won't get into, we're putting on the show in the concert hall, believe it or not. So it's going to be interesting, to say the least, with a glow-in-the-dark floor.
With a glow-in-the-dark floor.
Yeah.
That you have made for this.
No.
Nope.
It was already there.
They painted it. It's very pretty, though.
It looks awesome.
So, is this the first play that you've written, Winston?
It is. I never really took much draw to writing. Mostly, I felt it was very structured in high school when people would get me to try to. And I don't know if it's because I'm a teenager and it's in my nature to rebel against things like that. Or I just would never get into it. But it was too structured and I never want to. And I decided to take a year off from college. And I was sitting around and I was going, well, what could I do? Let's try writing. And that just kind of panned out.
And so when you were writing your first play, do you look to other plays? Do you look back on what you read, for example, in high school or whatever, as models for how you structure your work?
Not really. Every now and then I'll put a nod in my dialogue to some of my favorite authors. Like there's a Neil Simon, similar lines from Biloxi Blues about the heat and such. So every now and then you'll see my little homages to my favorite authors. But no, I try to base things off of originality.
What have been the greatest challenges on this project for each one of you?
Well, Ryan said that we had a technical error to get downstairs.
They're all counting on both hands, ladies and gentlemen. The digits are flying.
Technical error should be the motto of this production. Everything that could have possibly gone wrong, I think, actually has. I'm praying that, you know, at this point, the lighting grid doesn't fall on the audience.
Right.
It won't fall the audience,
by the way. It will not.
That's right. You may come to this play and feel safe. You mean mostly technical stuff as opposed? Well, there was also you lost one or more of your actors.
We lost several of our actors. Some of them because
not
of scheduling.
Not to war
problem.
Or whatever, but just
no. One of them it was because of a scheduling problem. One of them, she's just going through a very hard time in her life right now, and I don't think she could separate her personal life from her work as much as she should have. It was a problem. I still love her dearly, but...
And that was the role that you stepped into.
Yes. Yes, indeed it was.
Now, have you all done acting in high school and so on, and in Warehouse 21 situations?
I did. I started at Santa Fe Performing Arts, which is around the corner from here, actually. They were doing a program through my high school. They would bring students in and teach them and yada yada. And when their contract ended, I decided to stay with Santa Fe Performing Arts just because I very much liked it there. I liked the kids. I liked the shows we were doing. So that's my high school acting experience, at least.
And Ryan and I both went to Santa Fe High and studied with Mr. Chavez. And this is my...
Who's a great mentor for many.
He is. He is indeed. This is my 38th show.
Good heavens. always drama or also musical or...
Musical, comedy, everything that I could possibly be in, I have been in.
Most 35-year-olds haven't been in 38.
It's true. I've been in a lot more shows than most people I know. There are a few who beat me. I do know a couple people who are my age who have, in fact, been in more shows than I have.
And Ryan, what has been your favorite role so far that you've done?
My favorite role was actually the role of Silvio in a show called Private Wars. And it was a very odd part, sort of like a mix between Tony Soprano and Kramer from Seinfeld.
Whatever.
Yeah. I couldn't even describe it to you now. But the character, it was another non-play. But it was about veterans. You know, nobody was ever in uniform. They were just at a veterans hospital, and he had this really weird habit of flashing all the nurses. But it's a fantastic show. It's really funny, and it's got an ensemble cast, which is what I love. You know, it's when nobody has to carry any weight, everyone just sort of plays off of each other, and it always ends up working out in the end.
Is that how you envisioned this show, Winston?
I had hoped so. A lot of the original people I was going to cast actually ended up not being able to do it. So, to be completely honest, I couldn't have asked for a better cast. I mean, well, the people that are still remaining.
And you stepped in to play the lead role yourself when that wasn't your plan either.
I did. I figured if I could hire one guy who wasn't going to quit, it would be me.
These guys have given me like 120% on every rehearsal. They've been very much an ensemble cast.
So the play is called Through the Mirror. It opens this Thursday, which is the 24th of July, and runs the 24th through 27th, Thursday through Sunday. And then the following weekend, Friday through Sunday, August 1st, 2nd, and 3rd, and the Thursday through Saturday performances are at 7. The Sunday performances are at 2 o'clock. And the very first and very last performance are Pay What You Wish, which is always a great thing that Santa fans seem to do in theater. The number for reservations and information is 989-4423. And it's at the new Warehouse 21, which is on Paseo de Peralta, on the same side of the street as Site Santa Fe. Anything else you want to let our audience know before we go?
Pay What You Wish actually means pay more.
My mother actually did that once. I went to a Pay What You Wish thing with her, and she put $20 down.
It's the way to go. It is the way to go.
Nevertheless, for those who are on a shoestring budget, it also works really
well. Definitely. And we welcome all. I mean, just if you want to just come in and sit down, that's fantastic. Because really what it comes down to is just putting on a play in front of people and hopefully they enjoy it. It's, you know, I mean,
especially when so much work has been put into this show from all of us.
Yeah.
Winston Morris Green is playwright, producer, director, and actor. Izzy Buckner and Ryan Kochevar are actors. Warehouse 21, Through the Mirror is the name of the play. We will see you this weekend.
Thank you, sir.
All right, thanks for having us.
We're going to take a little break right now. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like right now to welcome Reverend Gail Tapscott. She is the minister of the Unitarian Universalist Church in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and she is in New Mexico doing a number of things, including on Wednesday of this week, tomorrow, Wednesday at 7 o'clock, she will be giving a talk at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Albuquerque called Mary Poppins as Spiritual Guide. It's a free lecture open to the public. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, who would have thought Mary Poppins as a Unitarian Universalist or as a spiritual guide?
Well, I think that the writer of Mary Poppins, P.L. Travers, as she liked to be called, her first name was really Pamela, was pretty conscious that Mary Poppins was something more than just a fictional character and something more than just a nanny. But I don't think that that's been widely understood, since the movie is the way most people know about Mary Poppins, a Walt Disney movie that came out in 1964. But that was just a tiny piece of Mary Poppins.
So the Mary Poppins book, which I've actually been reading since we've decided to do this conversation, is a very magical book with a character who, I mean, you know, Julie Andrews played her, and we all know that, and that's fine, but is much more of a mysterious and both stern and very mystical character.
Absolutely. I think the movie captured some important pieces, but as P.L. Travers herself said in a couple of interviews later, the movie didn't have a whole lot to do with the books. There are definitely some of the story elements that appear among the five books that came out from between 1934 and actually 1982, although the main ones were between 34 and 52. But Mary Poppins is much more than perky and cute and a good nanny.
So tell us about her character in the deeper sense of this character.
Well, in the books, she appears to be more mysterious, more a little more stern, not quite as smiley and peppy as the Julie Andrews portrayal. She never says anything directly. All of her little lessons for the children as they go on different adventures are kind of indirect. And after each adventure, in fact, she will almost deny that they happened and deny that they had anything to do with her. And then the children will often find at the end of the story some little evidence that they at least can know, oh, that really did happen. It wasn't a dream. So like a lot of spiritual teachers, she does pointing but not explicating to get her lessons across.
What would be an example of that in one of the stories?
Well, one of my favorite stories actually is called Halloween. It's not in the book that I let you take a look at. It's in one of the later books. And it's a story about the shadow. And
the shadow in the sort of mythological
in
sense?
The kind of in the kind of more the psychological sense, that our shadow is a part of us that we don't always understand or recognize. Kind of the in the psychology of Carl Jung, and then it's kind of gotten...
Robert Bly.
Right, exactly. That it's the parts of ourselves that we don't consciously like to own. And what happens in the story is that the children, the Banks children, receive a mysterious invitation on an autumn leaf saying to come out at midnight. Well, of course, you know, kids aren't supposed to be out at midnight, so this is automatically a very exotic event. And they go to the park where a lot of their adventures take place in London, probably one of the main parks in London, we can assume. And there they find all their neighbors and people they've known, adults, behaving very strangely. And what we learn is that what they're really seeing is the shadows of their neighbors, some of whom are being more pleasant and more fun and more jolly than they normally are in real life. And there are great little moments where one character will say to the other one, you know, you're so much more fun than you are in reality. And
so that person's shadow side is actually better than their real self.
In many cases. It just depends on the person. Sometimes we repress good parts of ourselves because society tells us to, and other times we repress what we think is unacceptable. So sometimes what a culture says is unacceptable is really the life-giving, life-sustaining, energetic part of a person. And without your shadow, you're not fully human.
Both directions.
Exactly. We need that, the sort of, to avoid, you know, metaphors of light and dark, which have become somewhat controversial, but we need all aspects of ourselves to be whole and to function fully. And that story, in a very indirect, magical way, gives the kids this sense. And the people who have the integrated shadow are Mary Poppins and one very elderly, wise woman named Mrs. Corey. So they do see that it is possible to integrate and carry your shadow with you from the story.
What is the role of the character whom we know as being played by Dick Van Dyke in the movies, Bert, who is the sort of companion of Mary Poppins?
Right. Well, in the books, Bert does appear. He's called the Matchman, and he appears first as a sidewalk artist. And there is an episode on Mary Poppins' day off where she goes off without the children, and she and Bert do have this magical day with the merry-go-round and all that sort of thing, somewhat like the movie, but it doesn't have the implications of a romance that the movie kind of stuck in. Although it doesn't really develop that, the movie kind of implies that Bert and Mary Poppins are somewhat equal and that there might be some little spark between them. In the books, it's pretty clear that Bert is more like a fan, an acolyte, another person who is able to recognize Mary Poppins as the special and unique teacher and kind of enlightened being that she portrays herself to be throughout the books.
There's something very interesting in the writings of P.L. Travers. She's written many, many essays. I mean, her life spanned the 20th century. She was born just before 1900 and lived into the late 90s.
That's correct. She died at 96, just in 1996. Uh-huh.
And there's an essay, I don't have the quotation, but she's talking about how when you are telling stories that are myths, they are best understood by children who don't have any knowledge to get in the way. They experience them more directly. And that seems to be connected not only toward how children think, but a kind of mystical, religious, spiritual type of thinking that everybody has access to, at least theoretically.
Well, that's very true. If you look at almost any world religion, the idea in Christianity that to enter the kingdom of heaven, you must become like a little child, that's there in Christianity. The Taoist felt that the purest essence of the Tao was found in children. And, of course, in Zen Buddhism, they talk about how you can't really begin to progress in your spiritual growth until you develop what they call beginner's mind, which is a mind uncluttered with preconceptions and too many rational thoughts.
And so it's interesting that the author, P.L. Travers, studied with Zen masters and Eastern thinkers and so on.
Yeah, she from her childhood on, she was drawn to kind of the exotic and unusual. And one of her first adventures, I guess, as a person, when she was just still writing a little poetry and before Mary Poppins appeared, at least in a fully grown form, she went to Ireland, made a pilgrimage to see an Irish poet and mystic named George Russell. And they were sometimes called A.E., and she kind of, in a way, apprenticed herself to him. And he first turned her on to Eastern concepts like reincarnation and karma and things like that. And that began to kind of play through her own thinking, which had been from more traditional Christian, largely Anglican kind of background.
And he said to her at a certain point, I mean, they became friends. He was a old man and she was a very young woman, and yet there was this spark of recognition, and he said to her at a certain point in her life, and she records this, "Don't you understand that we already know each other?"
Yes, and she also says in that same essay that she was completely flummoxed by that statement. She had not ever really encountered the whole concept of any kind of rebirth, reincarnation, re-encounters with people that you had kind of karmic ties to. And he just took it as a given. He'd been a student of all the great Eastern writings and teachings for years, as well as more traditional Celtic, Druidic type of mysticism. And he kind of took her on, as I said, as sort of an apprentice, an acolyte, and she was constantly amazed that she'd been brought into this wonderful circle that included people like the poet Yeats and many other luminaries of the time.
We're talking to Reverend Gail Tapscott, and it's so interesting because her parents were of Irish and Scottish descent, but she didn't grow up in Ireland, and then she sent this guy a poem, no cover letter, nothing but the poem, and he writes back, and not only it was to submit it to a magazine, but not only did he, to her great surprise, send her payment for use of the poem, but also said, "You must be Irish, because only somebody with an Irish soul could write this."
Yes, it was as though he recognized her through time and space, and of course then she made it a point to make a pilgrimage to Ireland to meet him in person. And it was really, a pivotal thing in her whole life development. She was in her 20s or so when this happened, long before she started writing for publication except for an occasional poem.
Reading the Mary Poppins work, I can't help but thinking, and I realized when I started reading it that I had read it as a child, and when, as an adult, I started reading the Harry Potter books, I thought, what is this like that I know? And then reading Mary Poppins, it's very similar in the sense that there is this utterly mundane, normal, kind of middle-class or upper-middle-class British life juxtaposed with complete magic and apparently impossible things.
Well, exactly. And we notice that it's the children who notice the magic as much as that, of course, is in Harry Potter, the wizards can be of all ages, but it's Harry, the child in the Muggle family that, you know, begins to recognize that he has these special, unique abilities. And what I think is so delightful about the Mary Poppins books is that they are, although they are sort of for children. You can tell the stories are a little longer than the average children's story. The pictures are line drawings, much like the way the Harry Potter books were published. It's definitely for older children, and certainly like the Potter books, they did attract and would continue to attract a lot of adult readers. Mary Poppins is definitely something for all ages.
Well, that brings up a very important point that she talks about directly in her essays, which is the importance of storytelling for adults, and she calls it restorying, which I'm not sure what the etymological connection is with, you know, the word restore, but restoring the adult, what does that mean?
Well, I think she recognized, and Lord knows it's even more acute now than it probably was when she was doing a lot of her writing for Parabola in the 70s and 80s, that many adults growing up in the post-radio, post-television age were never exposed to hearing stories either read to them or even sometimes being exposed to certain children's literature because they were already watching cartoons and so forth on television or listening to radio stories. And I think she feels that it's never too late to recapture the experience of hearing these stories and letting them kind of seep into you so that sometimes it's very unconscious. Just like you said, you didn't remember really knowing about Mary Poppins, but when you read Harry Potter, it reminded you of something. I think that's what the great stories do. They seep into us, and then when we encounter other things, we have some kind of a point of reference, even if it isn't entirely conscious to us. And that early sense of being exposed to fairy tales, folk tales, and things of that nature is kind of irreplaceable.
What do they actually do for us?
Well, you know, Bruno Bettelheim wrote a lot about fairy tales, and he had some interesting theories. He talked about the fact that some of the frightening things that can happen in the fairy tales can prepare us for some of the vicissitudes of life. Certainly, that's certainly one possibility, one theory. I think it also can help open us up to the fact that everything is sort of more than it seems. One of the constant themes in Mary Poppins is that nothing is quite what it appears to be. Everything can kind of open up into a larger world. And though in the books, of course, they're sort of magical and you step into pictures or you can think about a happy thought and start floating up to the ceiling so that it exaggerates the point. We all know that if we think happy thoughts, we feel better and we're lighter. And so it's just that she takes things that really happen and I think exaggerates them and puts them into a more literal sense and reminds us of things that make our lives richer and happier. If we tell ourselves positive things, we tend to get in a more positive frame of mind and attract more positive things. And
well, not only that, but there's a kind of knowledge that comes through what is apparently magical or mythological, which is a different kind of knowledge than analytical or sort of more down-to-earth, factual type of knowledge.
That's true. I mean, I think that people that are so tied, especially like look at scripture, people will say modern critics of whatever the scripture, whether it be students of the Jewish scriptures, the Christian scriptures, or the ancient Eastern scriptures will look and say, oh, well, this was added on, or this is different, or this word meant something different that it was translated. People like P.L. Travers would say that something doesn't necessarily have to be historically accurate to be true, and that the myths carry forth this deeper truth that isn't tied to a particular time or place or to a historical incident. That's why the fairy tales, for example, never are set in a particular place usually. They're set in once upon a time, you know, any time.
In a place far away.
Exactly. And the same thing is carried through with, like, you know, that same term we hear in Star Wars, long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away. So the story becomes a story of the soul, and the quest for enlightenment and the quest for whatever, the princess, the gold, the ruling of the kingdom, whatever. And it's not placed in a particular time and place so that we understand it could be our story too.
And that's something which seems to be almost as much of a basic human need as food and shelter.
I think so. I mean, I think people without some kind of sense of story and myths, you know, kind of tend to not be fully developed. I mean, we've heard stories of feral children who don't have language and therefore don't have stories, and it seems very difficult for them to ever develop beyond a certain point, even if they're then given, you know, food, clothing, shelter, and training and so forth. people that don't have any kind of sense of orientation in the world are just really very limited and in a sense sort of sad.
It does make one reflect. I was thinking of this a lot when I was reading, especially the P.L. Travers essays, at some of the real deficiencies in contemporary education, which focuses, you know, an awful lot on basics like, you know, reading, math, and science, which is fine, but that sense of the magical, which we had in school, certainly when I was young, and maybe they still do to some extent, through the quiet reading of fiction, or even through having teachers read stories aloud to you, that is so very important.
It is, and I think I often say to people, it's never too late to have a happy childhood, which was one of my favorite novelists, Tom Robbins, says that in one of his books. And by that I mean not just never too late to kind of regain some sense of magic, but it's never too late to have somebody read to you. I recommend to couples that they read aloud to each other, and reading Mary Poppins would be a wonderful way to start.
Indeed. We're talking to Gail Tapscott. Now, one thing that's fascinating is that you, in your own journey, became a Unitarian minister after it was not your first, it was your second career, mm-hmm. and part of your inspiration was having read Mary Poppins.
Well, yes, and in a very indirect way. I had read her as a child. I had been, had my mother had read to me, and then as I got older, I had read all the ones that were written at the time that I was a child. One of them, a short novella, Mary Poppins on Cherry Tree Lane, came out after I was really an adult. But I loved them, and I had this sort of epiphany one day in my 30s before I went off to divinity school, and I said, I must find Mary Poppins. And I called a friend of mine, and we went off to a children's bookstore, and lo and behold, there they were. I'm not sure they're so easily available today in Borders and Barnes and Noble, but they can be found on Amazon, if nothing else. And so I bought them all.
Or our wonderful independent bookstores here in Santa Fe.
I would hope so, and more likely in an independent bookstore, because they probably would more tend to be more aware of the literary virtues of this. And so I took the books home, and I found a few favorite stories, but I didn't do a whole lot more with them. But I just remember thinking, you know, somehow I learned something very important from those books, and it seemed to be about pushing the envelope and saying no to nothing. And when I was thinking about religion, and I had an interest in that as well, I started thinking, you know, the kind of religion that I would want to study is one that doesn't set any limits, that isn't dogmatic, that doesn't tell you have to believe this, that, or the other, but lets you explore everything. So Unitarian Universalism is a religion that draws on Jewish and Christian teachings, world religions, earth-centered traditions, and also our own experience. And Mary Poppins is all about experience, about Mary Poppins taking these little innocent children and pushing their envelope and taking them out to meet eccentric characters that many parents wouldn't approve of, and having adventures that seem almost illicit at times. And then, of course, she'll deny that she was ever a party to any such thing.
What is Unitarian Universalism? When you made this connection, and the little that I know of Unitarianism, just from having attended some services and reading a little bit about it, it doesn't, on the surface of it, seem like a mystical, magical religion, as religions go.
Well, the services themselves tend to be based on kind of a Protestant order of service, with some readings that can be, unlike a typical Christian Protestant church, can be based on almost anything, not necessarily scripture, but the format of a service is very similar, for the most part, to a Protestant service, with some hymn singing, hymns that are a little bit more broad-based in their theology, but nonetheless hymns. And, as I said, some readings, and it's largely centered on the word, with a sermon is the centerpiece, and that isn't always felt as very mystical. But within the tradition, we draw upon everything. As I said, one of the first things that our living traditions that we draw upon list is that sense of transcendent mystery and wonder, understood in all cultures and available for everybody. And so that is something that we are indeed open to, that each person can have those experiences and interpret them in their own fashion.
How and when was Unitarian Universalism founded? I guess that there were the Unitarians and there were the Universalists at one point.
Well, yes. As we know it now, the two denominations, which had slightly different origins but had a lot of similarities in both theology and values, The merger took place in 1961. Prior to that, they'd each developed on their own. Unitarianism, at its most fundamental, I guess, really means sort of one God, a unity of experience, and really came out of a concept that was around since the medieval times. When people began to really read after Gutenberg, you know, the press, printing press came out, and the Bible was available to be read by everybody. Some scholars, including a man named Michael Cervantes, who was a Spanish doctor, looked at the Bible and said, you know, I can't find any explanation for or description of the Trinity as it's been taught by the Catholic Church anywhere in the New Testament. And he was totally correct. It isn't there. The terms the Father, God the Father, and of course we have Jesus as the Son, and the Holy Ghost are mentioned, but there's nothing that ties them together in the way that Catholic and later on Protestant doctrine did. So he wrote a book called On the Errors of the Trinity, and was for his labors burned in effigy by the Catholic Church, and then burned in reality by John Calvin. So
they actually burned him at the stake?
He was burned at the stake for this concept, and they thought they had burned all of his books with him, but luckily a few escaped, because ideas are hard to kill off. So that kind of gave rise, it's a later point, to some other people, most notably a man named Faustus Socinus in Poland, and then later a man named Francis David in Transylvania, which is now part of Romania, but was then part of, now part of Romania, then part of Hungary, who created a religion that is kind of the origin of the Unitarian part of our heritage. That was based on this idea of the unity of God, and to this day there are about 80,000 Unitarians in the Transylvania part of Romania.
Very interesting. And so how did it develop in the United States?
Well, in England, many people, including preachers, scientists, and others, as sort of children of the Enlightenment, began to question lots of aspects of scripture and handed-down doctrine. And the German scholarship on the whole, the Jewish and the Christian scriptures, began to indicate that this was not that the Bible was not a sort of monolithic document, that it appeared to have been put together by many different people in many different voices through a long period of time. And this, of course, was considered heresy by some, but it was at a time that more people were open to it, and it was that Enlightenment period in which everything began to be looked at anew that really brought this kind of philosophy into kind of its time. And so a lot of people in England began to espouse this idea that the Trinity wasn't necessarily the only way to look at their understanding of the figure of Jesus and so on. So this became kind of the foundation for a new way of looking at religion. Now, in the United States, it really got its start in the New England area out of the Puritan parishes, when many of those ministers began to study this new German scholarship that looked at the Bible more objectively. And when they began to preach along those lines, they began to be called Unitarians and therefore heretics by other people. And finally, in 1920, a minister named William Ellery Channing preached a sermon in Baltimore called Unitarian Christianity. And he said, fine, you want to call us this? Fine, we take it, we accept it, we're going to affirm it, and yes, we are different from you. Yes, we do
so
have
it
a
was
different perspective.
The term was actually disparaging?
It was a disparaging term initially that Channing and others began to just embrace and said, yes, we do, you're right, we don't really think the Trinity is the only way to understand God and Jesus and the Spirit in relation to each other, exactly.
We're talking to the Reverend Gail Tapscott, who, by the way, is going to be giving a talk tomorrow, which is free and open to the public, at 7 o'clock in Albuquerque at the Unitarian Universalist Church at 3701 Carlisle Northeast. And it's Mary Poppins as spiritual guide. And getting back to Mary Poppins for a moment, there's an image in there which is so, I think, connected to Buddhism or you know, Eastern thought, perhaps beyond Buddhism as well. The carpet bag which she brings with her is empty, and from this emptiness she pulls out 7 flannel nightgowns and a bottle of medicine and so on, and gazillions of things, and yet the bag is always empty. And then, well, so, I mean, that's an amazing image to start
it
with.
It is an amazing image.
And then she gives these children medicine from a bottle, which in the movie is a spoonful of sugar, but in this, the actual medicine, everybody who tastes it has a completely different experience of it.
Exactly. And I think that's a metaphor for religious experience in general, that we all have slightly different images. She's another thing in her story, she talks about when she spends that magical day with Bert, that is the character played by Dick Van Dyke, and they have this wonderful experience stepping into a picture and going into this sort of amusement park and having a delightful tea and so forth. And she comes back, and the kids say, "Where have you been?" And she says, "In Fairyland." And they ask her if she saw, you know, Cinderella and Sleeping Beauty. And she says, "Don't you know everyone has their own Fairyland?"
That's
just
right.
Just like everyone has their own experience of the medicine or what's the taste, what you want and what you yearn for is a little bit different for each person.
And then for you as a minister, I have heard, I don't know if there's you or others say that, being a Unitarian minister is sort of like herding cats. I mean, if you're letting everybody have their own experience, what brings people together? What is the common thread?
Well, it is a challenge. I think the common thread is people have a yearning for community, and they have a yearning for what somebody once called a sort of community of liability, a community that feels liable for them, that feels responsible for each other. While we can go off and have our little encounters with the mystical and magical alone, we want to be able to come back sort of around a campfire and tell our stories. And I think that a Unitarian Universalist church, in the same way that some other religious communities do as well, provides that campfire. It provides a place where we can come back and share our stories, where when we're sick or we're down or we haven't had a good adventure lately, other people can encourage us and assure us that there will be more adventures and more stories yet to come.
Now, is Unitarianism a religion that is well known, that is attracting new? I mean, do you even convert to people who go to the church?
Well, if you ever heard of Ralph Waldo Emerson or Henry David Thoreau,
yes,
or most of the people that founded our nation, many of those, including Thomas Jefferson, once called himself a Unitarian. So, it's well known in that sense of being part of our history as a nation.
Although probably people didn't know that Emerson and Thoreau were Unitarians.
Many people do not. Emerson was a Unitarian minister before he became the famous Sage of Concord and the all-purpose lecturer and writer that he is known for. And I think a lot of people don't know. Some other religious groups, especially Unity and Science of Mind, have actually drawn on Emerson as though he is their own and don't really understand that he actually came out of that Unitarian tradition. I think everything, we have no sense of history anymore. We probably haven't had for some time. And people forget about origins. They forget about where things came from, and they only focus on what it is now.
So are young people becoming attracted to the religion?
I think it depends. We are actually, most Protestant churches are hemorrhaging members. Most of the mainline Protestant churches are losing members rapidly. We are at least gaining, but not at the rate, not comparable to the rate of the increase in population. And we would like to be more visible. I think historically a lot of Unitarian Universalists, and the two denominations before it separately, were not, especially the Unitarians, were not that big on kind of trying to attract new people. There was almost this sense that the right people will find us, and we've been dealing with that legacy for a long time. There's more interest now, I think, in reaching out and letting people know where we are, and we have been doing more advertising and getting our word out a little bit more in the last couple of decades.
So you're not limited to Christian scripture in your sermons. How do you choose your sermons? What are some, besides Mary Poppins, what are some examples of the kinds of subjects that you choose?
Well, it can be sort of staggering, I guess, in its openness. I mean, some Unitarian Universalist ministers might be more tied to the traditions and our history and our own norms than I am. I've been reading all my life 5 or 6 books a week, so I range pretty far afield. I try to limit myself to one sort of whimsical Mary Poppins-like sermon a month so people don't think I'm too crazy. But I can preach on psychological subjects, political subjects, not usually about a particular candidate or anything, but about political and social justice issues of the day and how I feel that all religions mandate us to take care of other people and to be functioning in the society that we find ourselves to some extent or another. and especially the Jewish and Christian heritage. I can draw on scriptures of other religions, you know, the Bhagavad Gita, the Buddhist sutras. Some of my sermons focus on practices, spiritual practice and disciplines that can help us be more likely to have one of these transcendent experiences. Sometimes a sermon could focus on something like, you know, being a parent who creates a spiritual environment for your children. I've done sermons on things like addiction and how that is a spiritual issue. So there's really, it's kind of like the world is our oyster, and it can be a staggering amount of freedom, which is why I think it's not necessarily a religion for the faint of heart.
And you're certainly your congregation doesn't know what it's in for on any given week.
That's pretty much it. It can be a pretty wild ride.
So you're here at in Santa Fe, among other things, going to St. John's and doing some courses in the Eastern Classics program.
Well, that's true. My big sabbatical project is to do more detailed research on the Mary Poppins books and on Pamela Travers and her background and influences, with the possible goal of writing a little book at some point that I hope would point some of this importance of her as a possible sort of spiritual guide for all ages out to others. And in the meantime, I'm talking about my theories that in the Albuquerque Unitarian Church and in other venues around the country. I'll be doing some talks in North Carolina and the Washington, D.C. area in the fall, kind of trying out ideas, seeing which of the ideas that I have about all this might be, you know, received the best, almost like, you know, using Unitarian and other churches as focus groups to see what plays well in the wider world.
And what people really respond
to. Exactly, what aspects they really respond to.
Now, is there around, for example, issues of social justice, much coalition among the Unitarian and other churches of similar bents?
I personally, and our church is involved with a number of interfaith projects. We work with Christian churches, with synagogues, with even people, Buddhist groups, if they have a center that's actually a community. We've done some things in the past with a mosque or two, things like feeding the hungry and housing the homeless that we can all agree on that don't get into doctrinal issues. So there's quite a bit of interfaith work that we engage in.
Gail Tapscott, Reverend Gail Tapscott, is a Unitarian minister. She's the minister of the Unitarian Church, Unitarian Universalist Church in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and she will be giving a talk tomorrow, Wednesday, the 23rd of July at 7 o'clock, called Mary Poppins as Spiritual Guide. It's 3701 Carlisle Northeast. For more information, 884-1801. Reverend Gail, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been delightful.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Brian Highhill and Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Jazz Experience. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte, and we will see you tomorrow. Ciao.